Last week, the LDS Church released a new statement detailing the history of blacks and the priesthood. For generations, this has been the saint's Achilles heel. Some struggle to understand how a universal gospel could exclude so many people. Others have struggled to be inclusive. Today, we will discuss the content, meaning, and ramifications of the LDS Church's newly framed position on this troublesome aspect of its history. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Mormon History Guy podcast. Today, we are discussing a very hot topic, considering the recent release of the LDS Church's new stance on race and the priesthood. Russell Stevenson is an expert on the issue, and so it's a lucky thing that he is also our primary podcast host. He is also acting as special guest today.
I guess I'm wearing many hats.
There we go.
I'm not very special, though, just so you know. I'm more like I've never felt like the special guest. It's like, wait, we have guests all the time. What makes me special?
What about specialist?
Specialist? Oof, I guess I'll accept it.
Okay.
When I was outside Evanston, Wyoming the other day, I saw a billboard with a person with disabilities. And on it, it had the words, "I am not special."
There we go.
And I was looking at it, I was like, oh, ever since then, like, the word specials not resonated with me. Very
right.
Well.
It doesn't seem PC anymore.
No. It's like, isn't it funny how, like, terms that were once considered rather offensive, if you were saying talking about, quote, a colored person, unquote.
Yeah.
Now you can talk about a person of color, and it has a more of a progressive ring to it.
Right.
So I think that's fascinating.
Right. But it's interesting how rhetoric changes, and that is relevant to our topic.
Indeed.
Absolutely. What we're going to do today, I will act as sort of questioner of Russell. As he is going to be, we're going to trace through the released statement and kind of go through, use it as a springboard to go through the history of blacks in the priesthood in the Mormon Church over the years.
That's right. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to discussing this with you, Kate.
Okay. I am too, to be with the specialist.
No. Come on now.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. I know that it has been discussed, especially when the ban on the priesthood was in effect, that blacks were never given the priesthood from the time of Joseph Smith, which turns out that is not the case.
That's a really interesting point you've made. And, you know, a lot of us have been raised with certain ideas, you know, about how the priesthood ban functioned. And I like that you started off with this because now we're talking about historical memory, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were all raised with discourse about the priesthood ban, about why it existed. I was raised with the idea that blacks were descendants of Cain, and that as such, they would have their time to receive the priesthood, but that time would not be for a very, very long time, perhaps not even until the millennium. So those were the racial assumptions that I was raised with. And as I look back on that, I hate to think about me even saying those things. I understand why I did. I mean, for one, I was raised in a profoundly white community. There were very few people of other ethnicities. I think there was one African-American young man, and we had some Iranians who had been adopted by a local white family, but really it was overwhelmingly, a white Mormon settlement in Western Wyoming.
Mm. So to help us better understand where you come from and how did you, at what point, or how did you become interested in making this such a primary focus of your study?
Well, I was working for the Church History Library, and I was commissioned to do a little research on blacks and the priesthood. And while I was doing that research, I discovered some key documents that had not yet been utilized in the research. I was familiar with some of the early black men who held the priesthood during Joseph Smith's day, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really think of them as being complex people. I thought of them as token figures, which in and of itself is a racist sentiment, right? Mm-hmm. Assuming that a man can merely be identified by whether or not he held the priesthood, and that is his only significance to the world. Mm-hmm. I disagree with that now. I see many of these black men doing tremendous things, right? Things that, you know, any white Latter-day Saint could have and should have been doing in 19th century Mormonism. Mm-hmm. So as I discovered these documents, I realized that I needed to engage this issue on a deeper level, on a personal level, to see how I related to it, you know, through my own faith, through my own belief in an all-inclusive God, my own belief that that all men are created equal. Mm-hmm. And we are all sons and daughters of God, and how unequivocal of a statement that is. Mm. So really my own personal awakening came about through my archival studies.
Oh, interesting. So then beginning a quest to reconcile these beliefs that you had, deeply held beliefs about the nature of God,
right,
about the nature of humanity, with kind of how you'd been raised and
exactly
and things you'd been taught.
Yeah, I had been raised with certain assumptions, and then my increased understanding of who these men were forced me to revisit my upbringing.
Mm. Cool, interesting. Well, I'm sure we'll get to this later, but I find the rhetoric that you've used about everyone's created equally, God loves everyone equivocally, it's really reminiscent of the opening statement, the opening paragraph of the church's statement. So maybe we can talk more about those sorts of ideas.
Yes, please.
But let's kind of return to the Joseph Smith era. So talk to us about what was Joseph Smith's perception of blacks, and how were blacks understood in relation to the priesthood and to the church?
Right. So Joseph Smith, you know, he was raised in rural upstate New York. It was like many New England towns in that it was largely white. There wasn't a lot of interchange with free blacks, let alone slaves. We know that, you know, there were some free black preachers in neighboring settlements, you know, who directed, you know, even some local white congregations. Whether Joseph Smith knew about some of these men or not, you know, it's not clear, and I don't know that we can come to any conclusions based on the existing record. But we do know that, you know, the rhetoric of the local press was strongly anti-slavery, and, you know, they talked about the evils of slavery and, you know, how slavery affected Southern slaveholders and turned them into beasts. You know, this is different from being an abolitionist. You know, an abolitionist didn't just want to condemn slavery; they wanted to end it immediately.
Right.
So obviously, it's important to draw that distinction, especially over the course of Joseph Smith's life. But Joseph Smith's upbringing indicates that he didn't really have the opportunity to come face to face with very many black people. Mm-hmm. And as such, all the evidence would indicate that he began to formulate his views later on in life as he came to be, you know, came to have these visionary experiences, as he claimed, as he translated the Book of Mormon.
Mm. Okay. So after, you know, he realized his call as a prophet and began ordaining men to the priesthood. How did, well, I guess I should back this up with, so there were two men ordained as to the Melchizedek priesthood, is that right? By Joseph Smith, or during Joseph Smith's time?
There were a handful of black men who were ordained to the priesthood between 1840 and, let's say, 1847.
Okay.
The evidence indicates that Joseph Smith, he ordained one of them to the priesthood. His name was Elijah Abels. Now, Elijah's background, he was likely a runaway slave from Western Maryland. He had made his way to Kirtland, Ohio by 1834, 1835. He had joined the church in Cincinnati. Cincinnati was a thriving multi-ethnic population at the time. There was, you know, yes, there was, you know, the black slums, and then the white part of town, but there was definitely interchange, in that Mormon community. There had to have been. Mm. So Elijah's baptized in Cincinnati, and after arriving in Kirtland, all the evidence indicates that Joseph Smith exercised a strong policy of inclusiveness towards Elijah. And this in the face of significant criticism from his colleagues in the priesthood, specifically men like Orson Hyde and Zebedee Coltran. Zebedee Coltran, he later recalled, and it's probable that he made some mistakes on the facts, but we can know that he certainly felt this way. He recalled administering the washings and anointings of the Kirtland Temple to Elijah, and he talked about how disgusted he felt at doing so. Mm. And he said, "I would not have done it if the prophet had not told me to." So Joseph Smith had to exert his prophetic mantle, his prophetic leadership, in order to get Zebedee Coltran to administer these priesthood ordinances to Elijah. Mm-hmm. Orson Hyde, a few years later, he would warn Joseph about his inclusive attitude towards blacks. He would say, "Are you sure this is a good idea? If we empower them, they will rise up above us." And Joseph responded, saying, "Go to Cincinnati." By this point, Elijah had moved to Cincinnati. Mm. "And you'll find a black man who is civilized and who is essentially a great member of society. He rides in his carriage." Black people didn't ride in carriages in most cities, but Elijah was able to. So in Joseph Smith's mind, Elijah had lifted himself up by his bootstraps. He'd kind of become better than much of his race was. And as such, in Joseph Smith's mind, of course, Elijah was therefore eligible for the priesthood.
Okay.
So there's not evidence to suggest that Joseph Smith wanted to give all the blacks the priesthood.
Right.
But he did say, blacks can be eligible if they fit certain requirements.
Okay. Right?
If they're good people and if they're upstanding citizens. Now, of course, you would think that this kind of standard would be applied to the white population as well. So, upstanding citizens, right?
Right, but I was going to ask.
But the evidence indicates that in Joseph Smith's eyes, he saw blacks as kind of starting from a rung lower.
Okay.
They had a greater hill to climb. Most whites, they were already going to be basically okay. They're going to be eligible for the priesthood.
Right.
But in Joseph's eyes, blacks, they had more to prove. They really had to prove themselves.
Right. And surely a lot of this was derived just from Joseph Smith's environment, from the general sentiment. I mean, that seems like an obvious thing to point out, but I know that to, modern ears, a lot of times we hear things that to us are just
outrageous, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And rightfully so. We are right to be outraged by those things. One of the things that we need to discuss from the outset is the issue of what historians call presentism. Presentism is using present-day values to judge and assess historical issues. So in our conversations about history, it's really important that we avoid doing that. Now, that's not to say that we cannot, assess their actions, especially by the standards of their day. And in some cases, we will find those actions to be worthy of condemnation, even by their own standards. But as we work through this issue, we always need to keep that in mind. So I call for empathy in this. Even a person that we find to be as to be saying things as racially reprehensible as Brigham Young did, even he deserves the same privilege that we grant of all historical figures, trying to situate him in his time and in his place. And then, if we must assess, and we must, assess him by the standards of the community in which he lived. Joseph Smith, as leader of a rather small religious community, he had to navigate a number of social and political waters. The best example of this is the Saints' efforts to colonize Western Missouri. The Saints had, Oliver Cowdery and others had explored Western Missouri in fall of 1830. By 1831, you know, there was a flow of saints that were beginning to try to establish Zion in Jackson County, Missouri. They thought that this was going to be the center place. You know, this is going to be where all the action happened. And the local settlers, they had a number of issues with the new Mormon immigrants. I mean, for one, they were just coming from a different culture. They were coming from rural upstate New York, which was generally anti-slavery, whereas Missouri was, in fact, a slave state. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, the first point of divergence. And it also doesn't help that the saints were talking about how, you know, the Native Americans of the area would eventually inherit the land. It didn't help that they were talking about land that others saw as distinctively American as being Zion. So you have a number of problems, but the fact that the saints were generally anti-slavery in 1831, 1832, that really pushed the Missourians' buttons. Mm-hmm. Even to the point that in subsequent years, the Mormons in western Missouri would come to be called Black Mormons. Mm. So, you know, one of the earliest Latter-day Saints, and certainly one of the most prominent and articulate, was a man by the name of William W. Phelps. He was the editor for a church newspaper called the Evening and Morning Star. In this newspaper, he issued an article essentially inviting blacks to come to Missouri in, you know, in small numbers. Blacks are welcome here. You know, we would like to have them in moderation. But when this article became known to the locals, they saw it as encouraging racial integration. And racial integration in their eyes was only one step away from, you know, interracial marriage. And that was a line that no respectable white person was willing to cross in the early 1830s, right. Or really most, you know, up until 1967, there were, you know, anti-miscegenation laws, and miscegenation is just a big word for, you know, interracial marriage, mm-hmm. on the books. It was in 1967 when the Supreme Court said that those laws were unconstitutional. Okay. So when the saints were kicked out of Jackson County in 1833, one of the major reasons was that they had come to be too closely associated with the black population there. And Joseph Smith was profoundly aware of this. He had read an article from – or excuse me, he had read a letter from Missouri Governor Daniel Dunklin sent to William W. Phelps saying that it was the saints' job to prove that they were not abolitionists. See, abolitionists were seen as terrorists of sorts.
Right.
You know, an abolitionist was the kind of person who would go into black communities and, you know, like sneak information to them and try to orchestrate revolts and spread nasty rumors about whites. I mean, abolitionists were subversives in the eyes of Western Missourians.
Mm. So the general approach of the church and its members was kind of teetering the line somewhere in between being an abolitionist and being like another Missourian who was
Right. And you see what you see happening after the saints were kicked out of Jackson County, Missouri. Phelps pulls a 180. He says, actually, I was kidding about wanting blacks to come to Missouri. And even more, we're going to prevent any and all blacks from being part of our society. We don't even want them here at all. So this was a politically expedient move in Phelps' eyes. You know, he'd seen what had happened to the saints when they were associated with abolitionists and black people. So he was playing politics, frankly, and he was trying to help the Latter-day Saint community to survive.
Wow. So very complex. I mean, from the earliest years of the church's history, this has been a really complex issue with...
Certainly, it's been a tumultuous issue as well.
Yeah.
It's been an issue that at one point threatened the saints' livelihood. So how did Joseph Smith respond to all of this?
Yeah.
In March of 1836, he authorized the ordination of Elijah Abels to the priesthood. We have a certificate on the file. It's not even up for debate. The following month, he issued a statement in another church newspaper, which is the Messenger and Advocate, in which he endorsed slavery. He condoned it. He said it was necessary. And if slavery were to end in America, then whites would be at the mercy of the black population. And he talked about blacks as being inherently immoral and really awful human beings, if even human beings at all. So you see, in March, he's authorizing the ordination of Elijah to the priesthood. And in April, he is saying what is implicitly the opposite of that.
Yeah. So from our perspective, this just seems like it just seems so flip-floppy and back and forth and all kinds of, it's just all over the place. But from Joseph Smith's perspective or William Phelps or whoever, would they have seen it as like such a...
Based on my reading of Joseph Smith and W.W. Phelps, the documents would indicate that they saw it as an issue of survival.
Okay.
That, yes, they were initially sympathetic to the black population. In fact, they even, wanted blacks to be part of the church. But if push came to shove, and if it meant the destruction of their community, they were not willing to go that far. So from the documentary record, that's a pretty clear indication of how the Mormon community saw the African-American community.
Okay.
And towards the end of Joseph's life, he was running for president, obviously, in 1844, and a lot of Mormons have made much about him. He was an abolitionist. He was not an abolitionist. He always made it clear that he was not an abolitionist. He would go to great lengths to distance himself from the abolitionist network. He called them pseudo-priests. He thought of them as participants in priestcraft. And in 1844, he even fined some black men for trying to marry white women. So Joseph constantly felt this need to do this dance, right? Even if I'm going to oppose slavery in my presidential campaign, which he did, I'm not going to go so far as to, support racially integrated units in Nauvoo. He still saw, slavery as maybe a reprehensible evil, but one that God will eventually take care of in his own time.
Okay.
Even with all of Joseph Smith's, dancing around this topic, trying to play politics, all the evidence points to, him at least supporting some blacks holding the priesthood, at least, any black who could rise above his circumstances as Elijah had, using Joseph Smith's own language.
Right. Maybe I'll put in a quick plug in case our listeners don't know that Russell has written a book about Elijah Abels, and it's available on Kindle.
It's available on Kindle. It's also available at Eborn Books.
And Eborn Books, where we are recording. Great.
That we are. That we are. And, if you want me to send you a personal copy with a signature, I can arrange for that as well.
Yeah. You can order that from your blog, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's
right. Mystery guy. Maybe let's move to the kind of the next era of Mormon history, the Exodus West.
Yes.
And kind of start talking about Brigham Young and how right. things developed as the saints moved west.
Right. So, as we start talking about the Brigham Young era, we need to keep a couple things in mind, especially as it relates to Mormonism and race. Joseph Smith's commitment to including black people was pretty much confined to him and perhaps, a couple other forward-thinking apostles such as Lorenzo Snow or even Brigham Young. That was, the state of affairs in 1844. There were several people who thought that Joseph Smith was profoundly misguided in his efforts. So when Joseph Smith died, you had the leading advocate for racial equality in the mainstream Mormon community, he was gone. And it allowed the Latter-day Saints to begin to slip into the sentiments that already existed in their community. But there is one noteworthy person who did not give in to that, and that is Brigham Young. So, you know, while you have people like Orson Hyde, who's, you know, he's beginning to talk about how, you know, blacks were, you know, not valiant in the pre-existence, Brigham Young is saying very different things. And we're going to talk about, you know, the episode that that caused him to say these things. So in February of 1846, the Saints leave Nauvoo. Mm-hmm. They settle in winter quarters. And while they're in winter quarters, there is a black man by the name of William McCary who joins the Latter-day Saints there. He has married a white Latter-day Saint woman by the name of Lucy Stanton. Lucy Stanton was fairly prominent. She was the daughter of a former state president. Her whole family had been long known to have affection for black preachers. And even in the Kirtland days, they became followers of a black preacher by the name of Black Pete. So they were very supportive of the black religious experience. And as it happens, when William McCary and his wife first came into the community, Brigham Young was fairly supportive of him as well. You know, the question came up, you know, what is my standing, William asked, in regards to this community? I'm black. Is that okay? And Brigham Young said, and I quote, "It's nothing to do with color," unquote. He even said that one of the church's best elders was a black man living in Massachusetts. So this is in spring of 1847, several years after after Joseph Smith had died. So we know that the priesthood ban didn't suddenly begin with Joseph Smith's death. It began quite a bit later, and we're going to talk about how it was implemented and how inconsistent it was. But Brigham Young supported William McCary, having the priesthood.
From what I understand, I mean, that's interesting that Brigham Young talked about it's not about color. Because from what I understand, it was more about descent, about African, being of black African descent.
Yeah, I recognize what you're saying. But in the context of this particular comment, Brigham Young was clearly supportive of Africans holding the priesthood.
Okay.
Because, you know, when he identified the elder in Massachusetts, he identified him as an African. He said, one of our best elders is an African in Massachusetts.
Okay. So where did this, I hope this isn't skipping forward, but I would imagine it has something to do with the same time period of where did the notion that the distinguishing negative feature would be being a descendant of Cain. That was understanding of.
Right. And it was possible to believe that blacks were the descendant of Cain and that they could hold the priesthood up to this point.
Okay.
There was no connection between, these two things, throughout Joseph Smith's era. I think that Joseph Smith probably believed that they were descendants of Cain.
Okay.
Just because that was such, that was almost commonplace wisdom. It would have been radical not to believe that. But it's one thing to say that they're descendants of Cain, and it's quite another to say they're the descendants of Cain, and therefore they're cursed as to the priesthood.
Right.
So Brigham Young, he basically accepted Joseph Smith's position. Brigham Young had a tremendous affection for Joseph Smith. Brigham Young almost felt like Joseph Smith gave his life meaning. Only a couple months before the William McCary episode, Brigham Young had experienced a vision with Joseph Smith. And in this vision, he recalled the two of them being very affectionate in a brotherly way. He talked about Joseph Smith kissing him on the cheek, and Brigham Young talked about how much he missed him and how he wanted Joseph Smith to come back, and how sad he was that Joseph Smith was no longer with them. The evidence indicates that Brigham Young accepted Joseph Smith's position, if only because he loved Joseph Smith so much. I'm inclined to believe that, based on later actions of Brigham Young. But regardless, Brigham Young says this about William McCary, and then shortly thereafter, he leaves winter quarters to go to Utah, and that's when we get, this is the place, and he says, here's the place where we will build the temple of our God and that sort of thing. While Brigham Young was out in Utah, and we have no reason to believe that he had given up his views on black people just yet, William McCary and his white wife are causing trouble in winter quarters. William McCary, while Brigham Young was gone, began to institute a form of interracial polygamy in the Winter Quarters community. Now, polygamy was already in existence there. Uh-huh. It was already being practiced. So it's quite possible that William McCary felt like, well, I hold the priesthood. And indeed he did. I hold the priesthood and I'm a member of the church. Why can't I practice polygamy as well? And obviously he's going to be doing it with white women because there aren't that many black women to be married to.
Right.
Jane Manning being the sole exception to that. So William McCary, in so doing, incited a kind of visceral rage in the Winter Quarters Mormon community. Mm. As soon as word leaked out that he was beginning to marry all these white wives, and to make matters worse, there was some hint of kinkiness. Lucy, his wife, would stand outside the door, making sure that no one came in. And it's very easy to see this, being a kind of a three-way situation. We don't really know. Mm. But regardless, the fact that William McCary, a black man, was marrying white women so wantonly, that in and of itself was enough to, cause Latter-day Saints to start issuing death threats. William McCary and his wife Lucy were chased out of town on a rail for fear of their lives. This is all in the absence of Brigham Young.
So when he came back, what happened?
So Brigham Young comes back, and it's clear based on William Clayton's journal entry that Brigham Young had indeed caught word of William McCary's activities. Because, during the travels west, Brigham Young was saying, you shouldn't act the N-word. You shouldn't be like N-words. And, you should be doing this, this, and this. Because, that's not very civilized. You shouldn't dance like them, eat like them, be like them. So you see, while Brigham Young almost certainly harbored those sentiments before 1847, you see an increased attention to it. An increased concern about racial integration in the Mormon community.
Okay.
He comes back to Winter Quarters, and he finds out what had happened. Now, what's noteworthy is that the very first comment connecting race to priesthood was not made by Brigham Young. It was made by Parley P. Pratt in April of 1847.
Really?
And it was in response to what had been happening with William and Lucy McCary.
What did he say?
He said, that man, William McCary, is not worthy to hold the priesthood because he is the descendant of Ham. Now, there was debating narratives about where black people came from. Did they come from Ham? Did they come from Cain? In his eyes, in Parley P. Pratt's eyes, the fact that William McCary had done this, it kind of revealed his true soul. It said, okay, well, this is really the nature of black people. This is what we need to be afraid of. And Parley P. Pratt, he had already tried to cast the Saints as a white church. Following the Missouri extermination order, he made clear to everybody that there were no more than a half dozen to a dozen black people in the Mormon church. He really wanted people to believe that the Mormons were a white church. So when this business with William McCary goes down, it just confirmed what he already believed. Mm. So Brigham Young comes back. Parley P. Pratt says, so listen, this is what happened. And Brigham Young, he is enraged. Because in his eyes, it's one thing for a black man and a white woman to marry. Yeah, that's their own business. That's weird. But he was still willing to let him be in the community. He was very welcoming to William McCary. Mm. But with all this polygamy business, that crossed a fundamental line, and he only learned the details of this with Parley P. Pratt's and others' reports to him after he returned to Winter Quarters. Making matters worse in Brigham Young's eyes, Walker Lewis, the black elder in Massachusetts that Brigham Young had referenced earlier, his son had married a white woman. So we see Brigham Young beginning to shift over the course of 1847. In March of 1847, he's willing to be tolerant. He's willing to be inclusive, as Brother Joseph had been. By the end of the year, he had had it. And, of course, this is upon hearing all of the reports of his advisors and hearing about, the almost mob uprising that had happened in Winter Quarters. So Brigham Young was responding to what the Saints had already carried out. in summer, spring, summer of 1847.
I have this quote of Brigham Young speaking to the Utah Territorial Legislature. So we're kind of fast forwarding to the Utah period.
Mm-hmm.
This is 1852.
Yes.
So clearly he's evolved from there, saying, "Any man having one drop of the seed of Cain in him cannot hold the priesthood, and if no other prophet ever spake it before, I will say it now in the name of Jesus Christ. I know it is true, and they know it." So tell us about how he evolves to this point.
It's a radical transformation.
Yeah.
So his very first comments connecting race to priesthood were in February of 1849.
Okay.
It was in a private setting. He was speaking to Lorenzo Snow. And Lorenzo Snow, he made an interesting comment, or rather an interesting question. He said, "Brother Brigham, when will the door be unlocked to the African race?" Now, Lorenzo Snow, he was relatively progressive for his peers. You know, he had gone to Oberlin, or he had attended Oberlin College briefly, and Oberlin College was known as the most progressive liberal arts college in the country. They were a racially integrated college. So the fact that Lorenzo Snow was willing to go there at all indicates something about his sensibilities. So he asked Brigham Young, What are we going to do? Like, can we preach to them? Do we not? And that's when Brigham Young said, "They cannot hold the priesthood, and they will not until all the sons of Abel have the opportunity to receive the priesthood and receive the blessings of the gospel."
All the sons of Abel, implying?
Implying that because Cain had killed Abel, all of Cain's descendants suffered for his sin, and they had to wait. Right now, eventually, you know, Brigham Young recognized that at some point that would happen, you know, that the descendants of Cain would receive the gospel. But that wouldn't be for a very, very long time, possibly until the millennium. Mm. So in 1849, we're seeing, you know, the first articulation of this sentiment. And you're also beginning to see the first discussions of how Utah is going to play into the slavery discourse. You know, the Mexican-American War had just been completed. Not long earlier, in 1848, and there was with all the new territory acquired, Utah being among those territories, there was a real debate as to what the territories would look like in terms of slavery. You know, was California going to be a slave state? Was Utah going to be a slave territory? Arizona, New Mexico, that most of the West. What is it going to be? And the Saints, they were at this point obsessed above all else with self-determination. They wanted independence from America, and here they had been basically forced back into the American sphere of influence. So now they're trying to negotiate again the competing discourses in America. And what Brigham Young directed his political representatives to do in D.C.
Was he was the governor.
He was the territorial governor at this point. He directed them to basically sell out the black population. He said, "Listen, I'm okay with Utah being a slave territory if that's what it's going to take for Utah to become a state.
Okay.
We really want to be a state. And if people insist on us being a slave state, then so be it."
Okay.
He acknowledged, we're not very slave-friendly people, but it's okay. They'll get over it, essentially. And when he gave that speech in 1852, that was a speech that was associated with the passage of a slavery act in Utah. It was called an Act in Relation to Service, and it legalized slavery in the Utah Territory. Now, obviously, this is something that not a lot of Utahns or Mormons recognize, that Utah was, in fact, a place where you could hold another human being in bondage. Obviously outrageous. When Brigham Young pushed for the passage of this legislation, there was virtually no debate on it.
Hmm.
So Brigham Young's words were able to resonate with this population. They were already ready to hear it. I mean, it almost passed as a routine matter. So what we're seeing here is that as the saints moved westward, as they had experienced the sourness of Missouri, the bitterness of William McCary, and now they're trying to distance themselves from America, they're beginning to see themselves as a new kind of racial community. And you see this fully articulated later in the 19th century, something that is fairly prevalent amongst most American-born saints. Some of the British were more progressive, especially James Moyle, the son of John Rowe Moyle. You know, John Rowe Moyle is a man with the wooden leg who supposedly walked back and forth between Alpine and Salt Lake City. Well, you know, his son, he recalled his sight of a slave port in Louisiana, and he was appalled at what he saw. He said, "You know, they're human beings like you and me." So, and you know, he came to Utah in the mid 1850s. So I want to make sure that people recognize that not everybody embraced this new racial ideology. But given the lack of a black presence in Utah, it was really easy to just sort of put it into the background, right? Well, we don't need to worry about that. That's not our problem. That's America's problem. Let them destroy themselves over it.
Right. So at maybe at its peak, how many slaves do you think that there
were? At its peak, there were a couple hundred.
Okay. Wow. So.
So not a lot.
Yeah.
Obviously, I mean, it's a tragic story. You know, just studying the lives of slaves under the saints, and you know, most of these slaves were owned by Southern Mormons, you know, who had been converted in the South, and you know, Brigham Young wanted to accommodate them, and in fact, at one point he was speaking with a woman who owned a slave named Jerry, and he said, "If you're going to sell him, please sell him to a benevolent man, but if you can't sell him, I will buy him and then I will free him." So Brigham Young was in some way involved in, you know, the slave trade in Utah. And there are other examples as well. So I would say at its peak, slavery was never even a defining aspect of Mormon life. But I would say that by the 1850s, racism had become a defining aspect, if only if it is a racism by separation.
Okay.
A racism in the sense that the black people are your problem. For the most part, they're not our problem. Leave us alone.
Got it. Interesting. All right, so let's move to sort of the 1860s, 1870s period, the end of Brigham Young, and then John Taylor coming in to be the prophet.
Right. So obviously, slavery is abolished in the Utah Territory with the Emancipation Proclamation. You know, the slaves in Utah rejoiced right alongside the slaves in the South when they heard about these words, and we have accounts of them doing so, and it's very touching. Brigham Young, he held on to his racial views throughout the rest of his life. And when he was interviewed by Eastern reporters and they asked about his position on blacks, he said they should be treated as they are, and that is as the sons of Cain. So he's actually becoming more dogmatic, more hardline in his racial attitudes. He dies. John Taylor takes on the new position of president of the church. And an interesting thing happens. Elijah, who had been ordained by Joseph Smith, approaches John Taylor and asks to receive his temple endowment. And to make a rather long story short, John Taylor ultimately denies this after hearing the reports of Zebedee Coulter and Abraham Smoot, one of whom had said that Joseph Smith had revoked the priesthood from Elijah Ables. So John Taylor makes his decision based on what he thought Joseph Smith said based on these secondhand reports. So what's interesting about this is they even went so far to say that Joseph Smith's willingness to ordain Elijah Ables to the priesthood was a mistake. With this belief that it was a mistake, we see the creation of a new storyline. That is that Joseph Smith approved of the priesthood ban, and that institutionally, church leaders would now prevent blacks from holding the priesthood as a general policy. Now, there had been, you know, talk of this in previous years. In fact, even when Elijah was serving his mission in Cincinnati, we have good evidence indicating that he was told only to preach to the black population, quote, as a matter of policy, unquote. That is why the branch president made that decision. We do not want, you know, him, you know, making it look like we believe in racial integration. But even then, he was careful to note, this is only as a matter of policy. At no time did the branch president ascribe to anything else. But by the late 1870s, church leaders are now saying, well, you know, because you have, you know, blood from the skin of Cain, because Joseph Smith had to revoke it from, you know, from you at some point, we, I'm sorry, we cannot give you your temple endowments. Elijah pushed back. He tried to say, listen, Joseph Smith promised me these blessings, and it's up to you to give them to me. But they refused. They wouldn't cooperate, and that was really that marked the beginning of the end of the black priesthood presence in Mormonism. Mm,
okay.
So, you know, really, for the next several administrations, and we're talking obviously John Taylor, but also Wilford Woodruff, Lorenzo Snow, Joseph F. Smith. In all of these administrations, they took this as a conventional wisdom. Now, Lorenzo Snow, he tried to, you know, kind of make some sense of it within his generally progressive mindset. He said, well, maybe this was a trial that blacks agreed to carry in this life, you know, in the premortal life. Mm. You know, maybe that's why why this is the case. And in his eyes, that was progressive.
Okay. I wanted to ask you about that idea, because in the church's statement, they talk about, they refute any explanations that have been offered for why this happened. And one of those is the idea that blacks were denied the priesthood based on some lower fidelity in the premortal realm.
Right. And, you know, we have indications of, you know, of this thought being tossed around even in the late 1860s. The Salt Lake Tribune reported that Mormons often talk about blacks as, you know, sitting astraddle the fence in the premortal life. And this was a folk belief. This existed on the ground. And Brigham Young, he adamantly disagreed with it. He said, that is false. You cannot be neutral in the premortal life. It is because they are the children of Cain. That is the reason. And it's interesting because how the Latter-day Saints grappled with this, I mean, they could never quite decide whether it was premortal life or whether it wasn't, at least at this point in time in the late 19th century, because Brigham Young, he disagreed with it. B.H. Roberts in 1885, he heralded it as the only reasonable explanation. But then in 1907, Apostle Joseph F. Smith says, well, yeah, a lot of Mormons believe it, but it's not really church doctrine.
Mm, okay. So some could have seen it as maybe the way to justify the contradiction between God is just and not everyone in God's church is given the priesthood. There had to be some explanation. It must have been based on their agency from the premortal life for something they did. So it can't just be this arbitrary judgment that God placed.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. They wanted to believe in a God that rewards good behavior and a God that punishes bad behavior, and merely having one skin color that didn't fit with the idea of an inclusive gospel. So, you know, they had to go further.
Okay.
And hopefully, one thing that's being highlighted here is that, you know, we're seeing how infectious this idea of racism was in the Mormon community. I mean, you look in 1870, according to the Salt Lake Tribune, this idea was common folk belief, even in spite of Brigham Young's views that they were the descendants of Cain. So you have a number of swirling discourses, you know, amongst, you know, Mormons throughout territorial Utah and presumably in other settlements as well. So, you know, we see that the rise of the premortal life doctrine was anything but revelatory. It was very much informal and ended up seeping into the thinking not only of Latter-day Saints, but especially of Latter-day Saint leaders.
Right.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, probably as they're trying to maybe deal with explaining this, they maybe held on to this idea. It caught on and it continued to be spread. And
eventually made its way up to the upper echelons of leadership, such as B.H. Robertson in 1885.
Okay.
So from the late 1870s until the 1950s, you see the institutionalization of Mormon race doctrine. Up until this time, you know, it had been, you know, Brigham Young making comments, and you know, and on the ground, it was sort of unclear. There's even a letter from a guy in Parowan in the early 1860s where he said, "I don't really know what the doctrine is. Like, what's going on? I think there's something wrong with being black, but there's no clear guidance for me." And then after that, you're beginning to see that the church is making specific decisions to exclude blacks from the body of the priesthood, rather than it being, you know, a competing discourse between, mm-hmm. Among lay members and leaders. You know, they're coming to a consensus and they're deciding where they're going to go,
okay.
and what their policy is going to be. And George Buchanan in the early 1890s, he said that we are the whitest territory in all of the United States. If you want to be white and if you want to be free from other racial influences, come to the Utah Territory. And this is published in the Deseret News. And as we know about, you know, the reading experience, when people see those kinds of things, I mean, it's not something that that George Buchanan just dreamed up and then was pushing upon the saints. When those kinds of things appear in the newspaper, it's almost always the product of previous discourse.
Right.
So, you know, even in the 1950s, you know, you see the saints talking about how they want to avoid certain kind of dance forms. They wanted to avoid the jitterbug because it looked too black. In earlier years, you know, they warned women about getting perms in their hair because then people would think that they were black with the curly hair. So you're seeing this being manifested in a number of aspects of Mormon culture and society. And it really wouldn't be until the late 1950s, early 1960s that the saints would begin to seriously revisit their racial assumptions, not mm-hmm. to the extent that they were willing to, you know, give the priesthood to black people, but, you know, just think about, okay, well, you know, maybe blacks aren't who we white Mormons thought they were.
Mm. And by this time, it seems there were certain things that, in retrospect, we could say set the stage or were maybe even catalysts.
Yes.
Things such as huge groups in Africa, and Western Africa especially, Nigeria and Ghana, finding tracts about the church, just hugely responding to the restoration message.
Right.
So that's one. The growth of the church in Brazil, a pretty racially integrated society.
Profoundly racially integrated. It was the kind of thing that caused 19th century racists to have a conniption. You know, if they visited Brazil, they thought it was an awful place.
Wow.
You know, the issues that you're bringing up, it indicates that there was an eclipse of factors, you know, a constellation of catalysts that prompted the Latter-day Saints to start viewing their own race in a new way. One of the best examples of this within the Mormon community is in 1947 when Southern States Mission President Heber Meeks took a tour of Cuba in an effort to see if missionary work was viable there. Cuba was, like Brazil, very much a racially integrated society. There were lots of people with biracial heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And Heber Meeks, he felt like he was on the horns of a dilemma. He didn't know what the church could do in this kind of context. I mean, we want to expand, we want to grow, we want to become a worldwide church, but yet we have this race problem. And in his report to the First Presidency, this issue comes up time and time again. What are we supposed to do about this? I mean, obviously, he believed in racial purity. He believed that being white was better than being black. Period. On the other hand, he wanted the church to have a presence in Cuba. He wanted to have a presence in the developing world.
Mm-hmm.
What are we supposed to do? He sends a letter to a Mormon professor by the name of Laurie Nelson. He was a world-renowned sociologist. He had been an administrator for BYU in previous years. He had worked for the federal government in the Resettlement Administration, which was a major part of 1930s Utah. And when he heard word about the church's race doctrine, he was shocked. And this in and of itself is interesting. He had never even considered that the church had a race doctrine or a race policy. He'd only heard about comments made. And this tells you how insulated the white Latter-day Saint community was.
Yeah.
They were able to distance themselves from race issues. Like it's irrelevant to us and just and not even talk about them. So, you know, Laurie Nelson, being trained as he was at very good universities, he went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You know, he had been exposed to, you know, global currents and ideas. And, you know, he believed in the equality of races. So he comes back to Utah and he's, you know, not knowing any better. He assumes that the church is as inclusive as he is. And then when Heber Meeks sends him a letter saying, so what's your take on the race problem in Cuba? He said, race problem? What race problem? Is there a race problem? Hmm. I mean, if we as a church embrace doctrines of racial purity, then I can't recommend that we send missionaries there because we're only going to cause problems.
Wow.
So Laurie Nelson, he ends up engaging in a rather lengthy correspondence with the first presidency. And he calls them to task. He said, listen, we're being ethnocentric. I want to see, as he said, the roots of war taken out of the hearts of men. And, you know, all of this was generally done in private, in fairness to him. He did eventually make his concerns public in a 1952 article, but until this time, it was a personal correspondence, and the first presidency chastised him severely. They said, you have the right to publish whatever you want, but just so you know, when you're beginning to entertain the ideas of racial inclusiveness that are really are disgusting to society in their eyes. I mean, they thought racial intermarriage was just – it was one of the most despicable things a person could do. Like when you're beginning to entertain that, Laurie, we can't get behind you. And in fact, you're on dangerous ground. So this highlights how the church was trying to expand into the developing world even as they continued to embrace the racial purity doctrine. The first presidency ultimately decided against sending missionaries to Cuba, which is interesting given that they had sent missionaries to Brazil to preach primarily to the German-speaking population there.
Right. Huh. So eventually these things are going to come into major collision, though.
Exactly.
Huge collision. And we see even that this was one of the – at the forefront – I mean, missionary efforts and the implications of having that racial purity doctrine with spreading the gospel to every nation. It just wasn't going to work. And we even see that when the official declaration is given, that's the first line. Like because of the response of people from all over every nation, we realize that we need to expand this. So it's just interesting to see that.
Well, yeah, and they specifically refer really to like the promises made of old by the prophets. And what's interesting about Official Declaration number two in this regard is that it is the product of a number of all these forces coming together. You know, the African saints, the Brazilian saints, people like James E. Faust, who was, you know, then a, you know, in the 1960s, he had been a state president in Salt Lake. He was a prominent attorney. He had been the president of the Utah Bar Association. You know, he was pushing for more inclusiveness. You know, people like Lamar Williams, Lynn Hilton, others who were all saying, listen, the time, you know, if there was a time for this priesthood ban, it's over. It is no longer sustainable. Even a 19-year-old missionary who served a brief exploratory mission to Nigeria, even he recognized it. He saw these Nigerian saints and their commitment and their faith all without any missionary presence,
right,
without any kind of support. Right. He said, the priesthood ban isn't viable anymore.
Right. This is not going to continue to be possible.
It's not going to work. And this is in 1961.
Okay.
So I've often seen Official Declaration number two as a call to repentance. Mm. And with repentance, you know, it's implied that a people have gone astray. So at one point they got it right and they did something wrong, and now we're trying to bring them back. And it's worth noting that Spencer W. Kimball himself said, I had much to overcome. You know, I had to overcome my own racial prejudices.
Yeah. He said he had much to fight, himself being one of the main things he had to
say. Right, right. And, you know, Marky Peterson, he had given a very pointed and offensive talk on, you know, racial intermarriage in the 1950s. So he obviously had much to overcome. You know, my own father, he recalls Marky Peterson answering a question about blacks in the priesthood. He said, they're not going to receive it in your lifetime. And he was saying this to a 19-year-old young man in the 1960s. And obviously that proved to be incorrect in a matter of about 15 years. And let's not forget the contributions of people like Lester Bush. He was tremendous. You know, he was an audiologist who had made the study of Mormonism's racial doctrines, you know, a personal project of his. He published an article called Mormonism's Negro Doctrine, An Historical Overview. It was published in Dialogue, and it spread like wildfire throughout church headquarters. I mean, Bruce R. McConkie was reading it. Spencer W. Kimball was reading it. Marky Peterson was reading it. And in this article, it made public the knowledge that Elijah Abels had indeed been ordained to the priesthood, and that the priesthood ban dated not to Joseph Smith but to Brigham Young.
So let's talk about efforts for reconciliation, specifically from the moment of the revelation, 1978, to the present day.
Right. The very first efforts of church leaders to publicly come to grips with Official Declaration Number 2 and the priesthood ban and Mormonism's troubled racial history was in summer of 1978 when he gave a talk to CES educators. That talk has been widely available and published and republished several times over the course of the past generation. In this, he said, forget everything I have said, forget what Brigham Young has said, forget what George Q. Cannon has said. We were speaking with limited understanding. Mm. And from where I stand, I mean, that's basically admitting wrong, admitting that they got something wrong, mm-hmm. right? Now, you know, it doesn't talk about exactly who were we, right? Or, you know, who was it, you know, who bears the responsibility for this? And, you know, that would be an issue that not a lot of people would want to talk about in the 1980s and 1990s. For the most part, you know, Latter-day Saints, they certainly didn't want to accept responsibility for it. They wanted to be inclusive of black people. You know, they wanted to be faithful Latter-day Saints, but they didn't know what to make of them. I mean, for example, there was a Ghanaian man named Samuel Bainson. You know, he'd been converted in the 1960s before the church was even there, and he was one of the very first missionaries for the Mormon church. He served in England. And, you know, you see throughout his own personal papers people making comments about how special his people are. Your people are so special, one woman told him. And, you know, you see examples of high-ranking leaders who just kind of want to be around him, right? Because they don't know what to do with the racial past. And here is this example of, you know, of the future. You know, Samuel Bainson, you know, the new missionary. And they wanted to use him as a way to come to grips with, you know, their own feelings of guilt, right? So this brings us to, you know, the latest statements. You know, there's a new heading to Official Declaration Number 2, and then there's this new statement in a race and the priesthood. And this is, you know, the church's response to these efforts. You know, it is certainly the most authoritative explanation in print on why the priesthood ban exists. And in the framing of the narrative, you know, the Mormons don't come off looking great. I mean, it's, you know, several examples of racism, you know, the embrace of slavery, the denial of Elijah to the priesthood. It's an acknowledgement that there were systemic problems in the Mormon community.
Do you have an insight about the timing of this most current statement?
I don't know the details about the most current statement. So, okay. But I do know that the heading to Official Declaration Number 2, which was released in the spring of 2013, that's been in the works over the course of the past 5 years.
Okay.
So. Mm. Yes. So that it's a troublesome topic, and it's one that's rightly caused a lot of anxiety. And there is plenty of accountability to go around. There's the famous saying by Rabbi Abraham Herschel, where he said, while a few are guilty, all are accountable. And, you know, then there's Tim Wise, who says, we do not deal with these questions because we are guilty, but because we are here. So however one wants to assign guilt, however one wants to assign responsibility, we all have some degree, some role to play in helping the Latter-day Saints move forward from this.
Right.
To root out all of the incorrect ideas that had plagued the Mormon community for, you know, for so many generations. They were so entrenched. And and now we have that opportunity.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, in essence, change happens at the micro level. Because as much as a policy can be changed, I mean, of course we know in June 1978, it wasn't like all of a sudden all these racial ideas and stereotypes disappeared. And right. they're still some are still there, lurking under the surface. And so
I've had conversations with people who were quite insistent that blacks were descendant of Cain, and no amount of, you know, church leader statements could ever convince them otherwise.
Right.
So ideas are infectious. They're like a disease. It's not like a battle where, okay, you go duke it out and whoever, you know, falls down loses. No, it's more intangible than that, which makes the battle all the harder.
Right. Well, thank you for joining us today. It's been a wonderful conversation with Russell Stevenson about race and the priesthood in the Mormon Church, the history of it, and the most current statement made by church leaders on the issue.
All right, it's been good talking about this. We look forward to having you all next time on the Mormon History Guy podcast. As usual, we try to, you know, understand the Mormon experience in all of its aspects from a variety of perspectives, using a variety of voices. And we hope that in listening to this particular episode, that we have in some way conveyed our efforts to understand Mormonism's troubled past and frankly, any responsibility that I might share or Kate might share in upholding that and repenting for that. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I've said things that aren't true, and I am still in the process of repenting from those in my early and uninformed days. So with that, we wish you well, and we wish you love. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.